That would be Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health. Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services. Via Agnew Benben, consultant with Agnew Consulting. They were very involved in preparing the report. I'll note for the committee that we have several individuals that are available for questions. Stephen Bookman from the Department of Law, Laura Russell from the Department of Law, Ashley Christofferson, Department of Family and Community Services, and Tracy Dobson, Director of Behavioral Health. And I'm not sure how you all have planned, but please come forward. I guess we have two seats, but you can do musical chairs as needed. Just introduce for yourselves for the record and please proceed. And my thought is we'll give you about 15, 20 minutes to make a presentation and then we'll open it up for questions from the committee.
Thank you, Chair Kleeman. My name is Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services.
Good morning, Steve Williams, Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Okay. First of all, I just want to thank the committee for hearing presentation on the report to the legislature for HB 172. Just setting this up, like many other states, Alaska's need for behavioral health services has outpaced the services available in the state of Alaska. There have been need for more robust behavioral health system of care and expand the existing resources, build on that continuum of care, and ease the stresses on first responders, public safety officers, and hospitals. In doing so, we can serve individuals in the community and prevent individuals from being held in a higher, more restrictive level of care. The state of Alaska, the Mental Health Trust, community partners, and others have been exploring the development of a system of care in Alaska that meets those objectives. In 2022, in the 32nd legislature, HB 172 was introduced and ultimately passed and signed into law by Governor Dunleavy. HB 172 creates an opportunity to transform the way we assist individuals suffering from acute mental health crisis. The new system outlined in HB 172 is designed after the crisis now or no wrongful or unwanted care, which has been successful in other states. This allows law enforcement mobile crisis teams to deliver individuals voluntarily or involuntarily to a least restrictive setting. To achieve this, HB 172 added the intermediate subacute level of care, which allows individuals in behavioral health crises to divert from institutional setting. It allows examination under a notice of emergency detention and evaluation and civil commitment to occur in a subacute mental health facility when appropriate. As HB 172 was making its way through the legislative process, were concerns raised by constituents, mental health advocates, about the pre-existing challenges with patient rights and commitment protections. As a result of those hearings, and HB 172 set a requirement for a joint report to the legislature that was to be delivered by the Department of Health, the Department of Family and Community Services, and the Mental Health Trust by October of 2023. Which we have sent to the legislature, and it's what we'll be discussing today. So with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Williams, and he'll go through some of what we'll be going over in the report.
Good morning. For the record, Steve Williams, Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I'd like just to make sure we're all looking at the right materials. So hopefully the committee has a PowerPoint in front of them. Maybe it's going to be shown on the screen, but we'll walk through and identify which slides we're on so that you know what we're speaking to. It looks like folks have at least copies of the report and supplemental materials as well.
You've got it here.
We're doing it now. It's actually the screen is starting to work.
Hold on just a second.
Give it about 30 seconds, and I think we're good. And you see it's... Give it a moment so it shows up.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right. So this was the slide that Deputy Commissioner Lasley was speaking to just a second ago, and now we're on slide three. So as Deputy Commissioner Lousley mentioned, as HB 172 made it through the legislature in 2022, it was really a piece of legislation that was critical to laying the foundation for this no wrong war model of providing services to someone in a behavioral health crisis. An opportunity to transform the system that we currently have operating by using lower levels of care, getting people to the right place at the right time, and also relieving hospital emergency rooms, hospital emergency staff, law enforcement, and jails from being, the, in many cases, the default response to someone experiencing a crisis. So this legislation, H3172, allowed for, as Mr. Lousley mentioned, the no wrong door model. So a provider that wanted to stand up 23-hour crisis stabilization centers or up to 7 days for a crisis residential service center would be able to accept individuals in a voluntary, which is always the preferred approach, or an involuntary status. And that is what creates this no wrong door model. Through the legislative process in 2022, there was a lot of discussion to ensure that we were going to be protecting the individual who's receiving care, the patient, and make sure that their rights are protected. And as that conversation unfolded and there was increased interest in that area, there were two things that were accomplished. One, HB 172 itself strengthened areas that provided protections for patient rights at the time. And then at the end, we were also looking at, are there other ways that we can strengthen the system so that patient rights are protected? And what are those opportunities for doing that? So the discussion as it unfolded really looked at, well, there are a number of ways and a number of different systems that are involved when we're talking about patient rights. We have state regulation, we have state statute, we have federal laws, we have advocates who want to see changes in some of those places. So what would be a good approach to looking at the system holistically and identifying maybe other areas that could be strengthened? Are there states that have other statutes or regulations or policies in place that actually we could be looking at to improve and strengthen the system? And so that is what we often refer to as Section 36 of HB 172. The Department of Health and Social Services at the time, and the Trust, and working with some of the patient advocates that were also involved in this legislation as it was going through the legislature, identified a way to really look at the system holistically and charged the departments and the Trust to come back with a report and focused on these areas that are on the screen. Now, the four areas on the screen that you see is sort of a synopsis of what's actually in the bill on page 7 of the report. These four areas have a lot more detail, so I encourage folks online or the committee to make sure that you're aware that this wasn't an effort that was led just by the departments and the Trust. There were specific entities that were identified in the bill to be a part of this process, which included the Disability Law Center, the State Ombudsman, patient advocates, people with lived experience, and others. So the Trust to help us get through this process, we put out a contract. Agnew Beck was a successful recipient of the contract award. Thea Agnew-Benben is here this morning and is going to walk us through at a high level the report itself, the structure, how the information was gathered, and then at the end we have some high-level recommendations to present to the committee. I would note that there's over 90 recommendations that were identified as a result of this process. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Tiag and Ben to come up and walk through the report with the committee. And then at the end, we have, as the chair mentioned, we have some subject matter experts who were a part of the development and the information gathering in the report. If there are questions from the committee that that the committee would like answered.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Sia Agnew-Benton, for the record. We can go to the next slide. So Agnew-Beck put a team together for this project that included three other entities. So we also worked with Dr. Cody Chip of Elevation Consulting. We worked with Jeff Jesse of Paladin Alaska. And then we also had True North Recovery on our team. That's a peer-led behavioral health organization that is based in Samatsu and also provides services in Fairbanks. So that was the team of folks, including from Agnew-Beck, myself, Becky Bitzer, Megan Carlson, Adrian Glasgow. So as you see, to develop this report, we, again, in line with what Steve and Jen were sharing, there were specifications in statute about who and how this report was developed. So we were required to develop an advisory team that had the composition that was dictated in statute. Out of that, we identified four subcommittees, and we added additional members to those four subcommittees that weren't also on the advisory team. So we had a legal subcommittee, a data subcommittee, a provider subcommittee, and a lived experience subcommittee. We also had a project management team, which represented the two departments and the trust and our team. And then we also did a very robust set of stakeholder engagement activities, and that included site visits to the facilities in our state that provide inpatient psychiatric care. We did many interviews, focus groups, actually on the next slide, you can see a little bit more detail there. So our partners with True North Recovery did lived experience interviews. We did a total of 14 interviews, but they also distributed a statewide survey and did listening sessions in all the places where we did site visits. We visited facilities in 12 different facilities. We went out to Bethel, Kotzebue, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Matsu, Juneau, and then we had a planned trip to Ketchikan that had to be turned virtual, the weather turns on us. We had a total of 5 meetings with the full advisory team. We had 20 meetings with the different subcommittees. When we went and did our site visits, we didn't just go and look at the facilities. We also interviewed law enforcement in all those communities, as well as did community listening sessions, had lived experience interviews. So we really tried to cast a broad net on each of our trips. We also interviewed some additional subject matter experts. So for example, with a public defender, Office of Public Advocacy, a whole range of other folks who are involved with this process, but we wanted to get a little bit deeper with them on to get more of their expertise into the process. So just a picture from the team that went up to Kotzebue, and just a reminder that we went and did these visits communities across the state. This map is in the report. I just wanted to kind of lay the land for you around who provides care. So it's really a combination of facilities, and most of them are not specific psychiatric hospital. So much of the care in Alaska is provided through general acute care hospitals, critical access hospitals. We have our DESBEP, that stands for Designated Evaluation and Stabilization. We really only have one formal one of those. That's in Ketchikan. There's another one in Bethel seeking that designation. They're allowed to do evaluation, and it's really just the examination portion. And then a DEP is a designated unit. We have one in Fairbanks, one in Matsu, one in Juneau. They can provide care for someone who's staying on an involuntary stay for up to 30 days. However, they also serve people in need of voluntary care. We also have some facilities that serve children only, so North Star Hospital here in Anchorage. We have the Psychiatric Emergency Department in Providence here in Anchorage that serves adults. There's also it serves adults and children, actually. We also have some voluntary units in Anchorage, and also, of course, we have API, which serves 70 civil beds, about 10 of those for youth and 60 for adults, additional 10 for people who are there for competency restoration. So that's the lay of the land kind of across our whole state. Just to give you an overview of the report, so as you know, the report's broken into two documents. There's the main report, and then there's a supplemental section. So in our main report, we have our first section covers the assessment of psychiatric patient rights and also the focuses in on the grievance processes. So in that section, you'll see a pretty robust inventory of accreditation standards as well as state, federal, basically a pretty comprehensive inventory of accreditation and state and federal laws that pertain to this topic. So we've broken those out by topic area. And then you'll also see in that section the portion of our assessment that we gathered from our stakeholder engagement and our advisory team that pertains to that aspect of psychiatric patient rights and the grievance process. And then following that, you'll see our recommendations based on that portion of the assessment. Then in the next section, you'll see the assessment related to data collection and reporting, and in the final one, the recommendations for that. So the main report really tries to focus in on what was directly identified in statute to be addressed by this project. The reason that we also have a supplemental, which I'll go over in just a minute, is that when we engaged in all the stakeholder discussion, of course, we got a lot of other input as well. So I would say one of the kind of overarching themes of this project is that once you actually get into psychiatric treatment, the rules and the structure is very robust, and those are generally being followed. That doesn't mean that people with lived experience of those environments necessarily feel that their experience was, that they were able to get all of their needs met in terms of their grievance processes. But in terms of what we learned about, is there a structure in place and are those rules being followed? Generally, yes. The problem in our state is there's a whole part of the system before you can even access psychiatric care. And for people who are seeking care, there is lengthy delays, there's periods of detention, there is very limited access to care, and that's where a lot of our stakeholder input shared challenges and difficulties. And so what we tried to do with the report is focus the report on the part that you asked for in HB 172, and then in the supplemental, there are some additional items that also support the report, but then there's a whole section on what we heard from stakeholders that's really about the broader experience. Okay, so just to give you first some highlights, and maybe also to say that this is a very complicated topic, and I think that it's a complicated process. It doesn't occur in the same way in every place. So when you try and get input from 12 different facilities all around the state, you hear things happening in lots of different ways. So also what's included in that supplemental is some helpful graphics to just help you kind of identify what are the steps in the process for this part of it, and what are some of the kind of roadblocks or barriers that people experience. So if you find yourself, as you're reading the report, thinking, I don't even know how this is supposed to work, maybe just pop to the supplemental and look at some of those graphics, because it might help just kind of give you some wayfinding through the work. So in terms of what's in the report, the assessment highlights from the portion where we're mostly concerned with psychiatric patient rights and outcomes, and this is also where we worked on the grievance process. So what we found is that there's a pretty, patients, providers, and law enforcement have very different experiences depending on where they are in the state. So there is a lack of alignment between how things are done on the ground and what the statute says. And I'm sure that's probably normal for the parts of the statute also, given how large our state is and how different our communities are. But there is a pretty striking amount of variability there. And in the report, you can read a little bit more about there's lack of alignment in some pieces between how the court forms that are used with the statute. And there's areas of the process that there's not much training for law enforcement, for example. So there's just some variability. I'd say that was one of the main things we found. There is a very constrained number of inpatient beds for psychiatric care, and that leads to significant wait times for people. That's also not really contemplated in the statute. The statute kind of is written as if, you know, you're kind of in town where, you know, you get picked up, there's a small period of detention, and you kind of are able to move pretty swiftly into the evaluation site. That's not how it happens. So there's all of this time where there's a lot of opportunity for variation. Another issue with the constrained availability of psychiatric beds is what has happened in our state is there's been a we've kind of conflated acuity or intensity of need with involuntary commitment. So because the beds are constrained, the highest level of care is mostly only available. And I shouldn't say it's only available, but it's the preponderance is for people who are committed involuntarily. So there is a limited access to higher levels of care for people who are voluntary. And that's partly because API can only accept people involuntarily. And in our DSDET units, you can be a mix. There's a mix there of voluntary and involuntary. So there is some access to care that we've added, which is great. But it's not meeting the need. And then also, as Clinton and Steve said at the beginning, because we don't have these kind of intermediary levels of care in place yet, it really means that, you know, kind of here you are in the community, and then your next stop is like API. There's not a lot in between. So that's obviously what we're all working to try and build. As I mentioned earlier, when we interview facilities, kind of go through, did the review of all the accreditation requirements, credentialing requirements, I wouldn't say any facility, you know, there's a robust system in place to make sure that those standards are being met. And there's robust systems within the facilities to make sure they're meeting those standards. So generally, we found, yes, the structure exists, the rules are there, the rules are being followed, there's systems to check if they're not. But in terms of how can a patient really access those opportunities to get legal counsel, to file a grievance, the onus is really on the patient. And so what we heard a lot in our lived experience interviews is that obviously when a person is in crisis, they're not necessarily even aware, like you're handing them a form that says you have these rights. Well, you know, they don't really even remember having seen that form. And not to say that they only hand it to them when they're in crisis. It's all around the facility. So from the facility's point of view, there's a lot of information being delivered. And then from our lived experience interviews, you know, obviously people are recounting something that was very traumatic and the messages are not always getting through. Things like patient advocacy, we did find one facility, API, has a dedicated patient advocate that's there all the time. For most facilities, that's not really available. So there are patient advocates, but it's mixed with other duties. So that's one thing that is in the report is really paying some more attention to, you know, how are we training patient advocates? How visible are they? How much of a trusting relationship can people build with them during the time from the facility? Similarly, with grievances and contacting legal representation, those opportunities are there. The information is provided. Again, the onus is really on the person who's in the crisis to access that. And then in our grievance process, it talks about an impartial body being the kind of arbiter of the grievance, and oftentimes that's the leadership of the facility. So many members in our stakeholder engagement didn't feel like that was very impartial, and so defining that better is something that we included in our recommendation. Okay, I'm just going to keep going, and then we'll have time for questions. So with data collection and reporting, so probably as you hear a lot, we do collect data here in the state. There's a lot of data collected, right? Is that data necessarily available and then analyzed in a coordinated way that helps us make system improvements? Not really. So what we heard is, yeah, we're collecting data. There's data collected on the things that you identified in statute. There's processes in place for that. There isn't, there's a couple of kind of nuances with this. One is going back to what I mentioned earlier about people are being seen in a variety of different settings. So if you come into an emergency department in psychiatric crisis, you are one patient of many with many different conditions. So the data reporting that's happening for you, there might be some things that are different, but for the most part, you're mixed in with the other patients. So it's not always easy to, and besides, right, someone might be in psychiatric crisis, but they may have other conditions happening at the same time. So there's, it's not always easy to pull out those patients from the data that a hospital is gathering in a day, right? So there's definitely a concern amongst our advisory group and in our stakeholders, like we had a provider subcommittee, that we really want to be careful. We don't want to stigmatize those patients by, you know, asking for additional data for them that we don't ask for other patients. We don't want to create more of a burden in terms of data. So you'll see when we get to our recommendations for data that it's really starting point is how about we really try and know what we already have, coordinate and analyze that, and then see what's needed from there. One thing I do really want to point out, though, in terms of something that isn't being tracked that our report concludes really should be, is what's called the MC-105. So that is the notice that you're under emergency detention. And this is a form that it's a court form, but interestingly, in our interviews, there's a lot of different interpretations of what it is and where it goes and who's responsible for it. So if you are brought by a law enforcement officer to an emergency department, most of the time that officer is going to fill out an MC-105, you know, when you're there. However, if you then get evaluated or examined and they say you don't really meet criteria and you don't want to stay, you know, and if the person doesn't want to stay, then that MC-105 really doesn't go anywhere. If that person gets examined and ends up initiating an ex parte order, then that 105 will go along with that other order. And it might also be scanned into their chart, they're admitted. But then it's in a chart, it doesn't go anywhere else. So as a system, we currently don't know how many people are being held under an emergency detention. So this is before you start initiating the ex parte. It's the period where you're deciding if you're going to do that or not. But what happens in a lot of communities around our state is that period where you're under that emergency detention can be quite lengthy. It could be days because you could be put under detention by a law enforcement officer, and then it might take, because of weather, transport, other things, quite a while for you to get to the place where you can actually be examined by a medical professional. And so because we don't submit that MC-105, we don't really know how many or for how long. So that's a real data point that our report really recommends should be tracked. And we did find that there was one region where the troopers did track it, and they could have easily told us how many they had signed in a year. But for the most part, we didn't find from law enforcement or hospital that was easily pullable. The hospitals have it in the patient records, but no way to get that out, right? Okay, so the supplemental has a series of appendices in it. So the first one is really almost like a bibliography. So we did a literature review, and then as part of our process, people sent us stuff to read. So we listed all that for you there. Appendix B is the section I was referring to earlier. It's what we titled it as the stakeholder vision and access. I think it actually says appropriate and timely access to treatment, stabilization, and discharge. And what we tried to do in this section is really walk you through, or anyone who's not familiar with this process, what is it really like for an Alaskan to take this whole journey from the point in their community where they start going into crisis and trying to seek care, getting care, and getting back home again. So that's what Appendix B does. And part of the reason we did that is that when we started the advisory team process, some of the members said, okay, we're trying to assess adequacy, but what are we assessing it against? Like, what are the criteria? Like, how do we know what we're trying to do? So they articulated a kind of vision, and I have a graphic on the next page to show you what that looks like. And then also as part of that vision, they have a whole set of kind of recommendations that seek to implement that vision. So again, that's the part that's bigger than the scope of what you asked for in statute, but I think it's pretty valuable. And then that's an example of one of those graphics that breaks the whole process into some chunks for you to, you know, just digest a little bit and learn how it works. Appendix C is a section on psychiatric advance directives. We did ask about that in all of our interviews. You can see how other states do that and just get a little bit more information on that. Appendix B is previously proposed legislation around the grievance process. So that's come before the legislature a few times, and so you can read about that. Appendix B has a comparison of grievance processes in other states. Appendix F is quite long. There's 90-plus recommendations from this process. We tried to organize them by topic areas for you. I think there's maybe 12 topic areas, though, so there's a lot in there. If you're thinking to yourself, well, what should we do? You could go through that whole table, and you'll get a lot of ideas from that. And then Appendix G is the public comments that we received and the state's response to that public comment. So just, I think I'm almost done here. I just wanted to pop up this graphic. When we were working on the vision with the advisory team, this is a graphic that we developed probably 10 years ago to, I think, try and think about long-term care and elders. It's proved to be a helpful model. And so in the large circle there, what we're trying to show is all the different pieces that help people maintain their independence in their community. And then as you go to the right, when people need higher levels of care, what are those points? And then how do we bring people back home again? So that's what that vision graphic is sharing with you. In terms of our recommendations, we tried to break them into a few different categories. In terms of what the legislature can do, the first one is really, kind of taking a look at this whole process, which seems like a lot. As we got into it, it was clear that it would be a big process. There's a lot of important things that people don't necessarily have clear consensus on, but there's also a lot of things in the statutes that, at least in how it's implemented, that probably should be looked at. One of our first recommendations is to make sure that all patients, all psychiatric patients, whether they're voluntary or involuntary, are entitled to the grievance rights that are in statute. Right now, those aren't necessarily all implemented the same in all these different settings where people access care. Institute a requirement for law enforcement to receive training on this whole process. There's some real variability there around the state. Defining impartial body, as I mentioned earlier, enacting a psychiatric patient care ombudsman office in statute. So it's kind of interesting. The ombudsman we have oversees API because that's part of her purview. But if you're getting psychiatric care in other locations, even if you're involuntary, you don't necessarily have a specific ombudsman that you can go to. So that was something that we learned. And conducting that comprehensive review and update of the statute is another recommendation. In terms of what departments can do, first, really reviewing all the court forms and making sure that they align with statute and that they're consistent. Develop and provide some training to really kind of clearly define the different roles for the different facility types and people within those facilities specific to patient rights. So there's some variability there as well. And then review additional tracking of the MC-100, the 305, the 105, and what can be done kind of with our new, not so new now, but the DEFDEP coordinator. And then, as I mentioned, there's 90 other recommendations for you to check out as well. And then I'll hand it off to Emily for some closing comments.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, and I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health. And I just want to thank Ms. Benbem and Agnew Beck for their work on this report. It was a large effort with many moving pieces, as seen through this presentation. I also want to especially thank those who have lived experience and those advocates who have taken time to share their experiences. It requires a tremendous amount of courage to share experiences of traumatic and vulnerable events. And I know everyone here today, all the representatives from the Department of Health, Family and Community Services, and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, deeply appreciate and are grateful for their participation for those with direct system experience. Ultimately, I think the measure of how well a system works is evidenced by those who experience it. And I think this report has highlighted ways that the system can and should be improved to further protect for experiencing psychiatric disease. The complexity of the system that patients traverse when they experience an emergency is really apparent, I think, in the number of agencies, divisions, and departments that are kind of highlighted throughout this report, as well as the number of recommendations, over 90 recommendations. I mean, that denotes a system that is made up, again, of multiple branches of government. So it's not even a single division or multiple divisions of departments. But when a patient enters the system, they are touched by individuals that are serving multiple different agencies and departments. And, you know, again, I think this highlights both the complexity of the patient experience as they experience a psychiatric emergency and the challenges in developing a system that supports and protects patients and their rights as they move through that system. There is room for all of us to contribute in improving the system and working to ensure that patient rights are clearly understood by everyone from the initial emergency responder to the staff providing direct care. The three agencies of the legislature tasked with outlining this report are here today, and we appreciate the insight, wisdom, and having this report really be developed by three different agencies coming together. We remain committed to beginning the process of working through and implementing recommendations that are described in the report and in the presentation, and we look forward to engagement with other agencies and with the legislature. So thank you for your time today, and thank you to everyone participated. We have a number of different subject matter experts here who can provide answers to your questions, and so Mr. Chair, we make municipal chairs depending on the questions that are asked.
Thank you very much. Before we open it up for questions from the committee, I just want to note that in the legislative history, before there was House Bill 172, there was Senate Bill 120, sponsored by Senator Giesel, which was actually what allowed crisis intervention centers. The crisis HB 172 was crisis residential, but we actually did crisis stabilization centers in 2020 in the midst of COVID. So just a note that that wasn't part of the history. Open up questions from members of the committee. There's somebody that people at the table don't have the answer, they'll call somebody up. Senator Kopp?
Through the chair to DC Ritchie. There's a lot of recommendations here, and there's complexities within them. There's certainly entanglements or prerequisites. You've got to do this before you can do that. Sometimes you need a part of something done before you can start the other thing that you need to do. Considering all that, has there been discussion about a comprehensive improvement plan that takes into account the sequence and interrelation of the various things that need to be done? Like, I note that court forms need to be looked at, but if there's legislative fixes that are changing the requirements, then the forms will be so that there's, I want to say I absolutely respect a great deal of work that will be required in order to design the change sequence and the change management processes so that you come out the other end of the tunnel with the products that you really want out of all this. So, kind of a long statement, but it's really a question. So any thoughts on how this will all be managed going forward?
To the Chair, Senator Kaufman, for the record, Deputy Chair of the Department of Health. You know, I think that is the next step in the process for us. As you can see, I outlined, and I know we keep repeating this, but I think it's really important. There are so many different agencies and branches of government that are necessary to address even kind of those priority recommendations. I think to your point, we together, now that we have the information, now that we have the report, and say, okay, what is implementation? What does realistic implementation look like? How do we prioritize that? And needs to be part of that discussion.
Well, thank you. Yes, just way of follow up. In management of complex tasks like this, I've seen basically schedules created that interconnect various tasks so you have clear visibility on the resource requirements and also the interrelationship of those tasks, that this task is dependent upon that. So I'd say in project management terms, so a resource-loaded master schedule that starts to put everything in its place so that you can work through in parallel and sequence might be a tool to help manage this. Thank you very much.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And thank you both for the presentation. I'm really thankful for it as it helps unpack a little bit of the process and then also goes into those recommendations, which I will love to hear more of as there's so many on the back end. And I do have two questions. I'm going to ask my first, and hopefully I have time for my second at a later point after we've had an opportunity for everyone to ask. But I really want to get back to that on page 9, where there's debate on the impartial body regarding a state grievance process. And I'm very curious as to the reasons why we should or maybe should not formalize a statewide grievance process. But my question for the report is, was there any significant conclusions on the ways the legislature should proceed in this regard, helping to support that work or potentially create that space?
And through the chair, you said page 9 that
of the slide deck.
Document, of the slide deck.
Where it says the debate on impartial body.
Through the chair, this is the Agnew member, Ms. Agnew Beck. Let's see. I'm not sure exactly where to start. So definitely, yes.
Let me refine the question for her.
Yeah.
Did the work come up with a recommendation for a definition of impartial body?
No.
It may be a broader question than that.
No. But I think there's two things that kind of were, I feel like, more consensus. One is the appointment of an ombudsman that could be for anyone receiving psychiatric care, especially in voluntary care. So that is something that exists if you're an API and a lot of involvement there. In fact, the ombudsman receives, you know, very regular reporting from API and it's a pretty close relationship. But just if you were receiving a similar level of care in a different facility, you wouldn't have access. So that was one thing I think is, and also maybe addressing Senator Kaufman's question as well. There certainly are things that are kind of low-hanging fruit here. And we really tried to pull from all those 90, what are some of the things that are more discrete and could be accomplished. So we have tried to highlight those. In terms of a statewide grievance process, I don't want to say that there was clear consensus on that, but I do think that there is a fair bit of consistency in the sense that accreditation requires a similar process from similar facilities. And the reporting of certain levels of grievance and other types of like patient injury, staff injury, that does go to the state right now to our health facility licensing office, and they respond. There's a direct connection with CMS. I mean, that's a whole process that exists and functions. Whether you're actually getting information from that that's helpful, again, not a lot of consensus, because some people believe that the lack of transparency there is kind of hiding something, but other folks believe that no, you know, that's some of it's protected health information, some of it is available if you wanted it, but it's not necessarily stuff that we would report. And even if we did report, for example, a facility that has a lot of grievances, maybe they just have a really good process for helping people voice their grievances. So it's easy to draw the wrong conclusion, I think, sometimes. So I think the answer, not a lot of consensus about what that consistent process would look like, in addition to what we already have. But the ombudsman, I think people would support that. And to no, I don't think there was consensus around impartial body, except that I think many people on the advisory team believe that the head of that facility is not necessarily impartial.
I know I sort of changed the question a little bit, but any follow-up on that? And you had a second question?
I do have a second question if there's
please,
time.
Please.
So my question is, and I was looking through the recommendations and had a great conversation with the director of API around some of his interest around culturally relevant care, and if there was any recommendations in the report on culturally responsive care, culturally relevant care, or if you've received feedback from outside stakeholders that aren't incorporated in this report regarding that component.
Through the chair, this is the Agnew-Bemben. So in the supplement, in the section that has kind of the stakeholder vision, the way that we heard about that is when we can provide care closest to home, we have a much better chance of providing culturally relevant care to people. So absolutely, it's a priority. You know, there's many things that we heard, and, you know, there's so much that goes into well-being, I think, as we're all aware, and things such as food, being able to speak your language, being having a person who's caring for you look similar to you. Those are part of the therapeutic experience. So when instead your mode of transport is only through law enforcement, you're handcuffed, you're taken to a place where you don't know anyone and treated by people who don't look like you, that doesn't decrease the trauma of the experience. So the way that we heard that, and I would say heard it very consistently throughout, is that the more we can provide care in voluntary settings, the more we can provide care closer to home, the more that we can empower regions and communities to provide that care, which really is the crisis now model. So if we could figure out how to do mobile crisis teams everywhere, we would really be able to empower people in communities to help when there's a crisis. You know, if we could do crisis centers regionally, same thing, we'd provide that voluntary access to care. So I think that's how we did that.
Senator Keel. I will just say, after you had a couple of, Senator Gisela, chance for a couple of questions, I may not have time for my question. Please. Could you bring up slide 12? I think it plays onto your responses just now to the last. There's a lot of discussion in the report's recommendation about data. Data is very popular right now. We're all looking for ways to analyze it and glean insights from it. And there were certainly in the appendices some concerns from providers about making sure we know what we're after before we ask them to retool medical information systems and health data systems, which are large, expensive, federally regulated, and difficult on the best of days. What sorts of insights might we hope to glean by if we were to dive into the data question? Because I will be absolutely gobsmacked if the first thing we find, the first 10 things we find, aren't do what's on this slide, right? More behavioral health services, more connection support, more basic needs in communities, culturally relevant, all the things that are in the vision here. Are there other things we think we might find if we were to get more and different data? Or do we just need to work on this for the next decade and then maybe take a look?
Through the Please. Chair.
Let us know who you are for the people that are.
So it's both. We need to keep working on this, been working on it for a long time and still need to keep doing that. And in that section of the supplemental that surrounds this, I just read it again this morning and I was like, yeah, good. Like there's some really good things in there in terms of specifics around what we need to do. In terms of the data, so what we don't do a good job with here in our very big state with very few people is actually track what happens to people. So we collect a lot of data, but we don't necessarily connect the dots very well. So right now we're collecting data in lots of different places, but if I asked you, or you asked me actually, because we've been asked this question numerous times, how many people are waiting, like right now, waiting for a bed or waiting to be evaluated, waiting to get to an evaluation location? We wouldn't be able to tell you. How long have they been waiting? We wouldn't know. So how long are people waiting, you know, at a DES to get to API? Maybe we'd have a little bit more information there, but only because it's being done fairly manually. So there's a lack, and it goes back to what D.G. Ritchie was saying, where there isn't like one entity that oversees this process. It involves law enforcement, courts, hospitals, behavioral health, and it's all different departments. So to me, that's where one of the data, the top sort of recommendation that we pulled out for data is kind of a coordinating entity. So before we ask for more data, let's actually coordinate the pieces that we have, because the courts do quite a bit. We have the health facilities data reporting, which we use a lot. It's a great batch of data. It doesn't get used that much, I don't think. But anyway, we use it, and it's great. So if we could actually coordinate the data to tell a story and to show us how long are people waiting, how many people are waiting, that would then help us see where and how we need to make improvements first. And so to me, it's not starting with more data. It's starting with what do we have, what story is it telling us, and then from there, do we need different data points, you know, or do we need to just make some changes based on what we see.
Yeah, this is a really excellent report. It's easy to read and see what you recommend. It's well done. You know, I come from the framework of community care, right? And this and you took on a big project, right? And this focuses a lot, it feels like to me, on institutions versus, for example, partial hospitalization, which is so much less expensive, right? And maybe has better outcomes. Maybe that's something that we look at down the road. But I appreciated that you called out schools in here. That's a critical access point for a lot of our citizens who are students, little people. Did you look into that very much, or simply mention it as something to be aware of? And the partial hospitalization, did you look into any legal changes that need to happen, statute changes? One of the things I think about with the school piece is age of consent. Was that a discussion at all?
Through the chair, this is Sia Agnew-Bemman. Specifically in this report, we didn't dig further into that other than to note that oftentimes when children or adolescents, I guess two things, when children or adolescents have a psychiatric crisis, even in school, they often end up in an emergency department, and they end up staying in emergency departments much longer than others. And from a different project we worked on, we know also that if you are on Medicaid, you have very limited outpatient access because there's just a smaller group of providers. And so that's a real gap. This project really did focus, like you said, more on the institutional piece because we're focused on patient rights and the grievance process. But you're pointing to exactly what the stakeholders pointed to, which is if you can't get into the appropriate level of care, then that's a problem too. And so that's where things like expanding access to school-based behavioral health is very helpful. And also with mobile crisis teams, they actually do a lot with schools. So they go, when they're allowed to, they go into the schools frequently. In fact, the ones we visit in Arizona spend a lot of time there. And the one in Anchorage is spending quite a bit in there too. So, schools are a really wonderful place to provide that access to behavioral health care because it's a very natural setting. So I think anything we can do to expand that is part of the community piece that helps people not escalate to the point where they need this institutional level of care.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, one other
absolutely
comment rather than a question. Access to care requires that healthcare providers are being reimbursed. And a big problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I just want to say, because I know we're going to run out of time, this is a really good report. I kept, as I read it, I wondered why Appendix B wasn't part of the main report. And that seems like a big part is the stakeholder input, but it's there in Appendix B. So those that haven't read the report, I would certainly say take a look at that. The one area that I had a question about, this is about kind of that before and after one, and after services when one is in more of an institutional setting. We heard, and I actually have to confess, I don't remember what those DFCS or Department of Health, but we heard in connection with the federal investigation on youth mental health treatment and people being sent out of state and the lack of resources in state. In that report, we only heard that it was North Star that was providing inpatient child services, and it wasn't until I read this report that there's actually inpatient services being provided to youth by Alaska Psychiatric Institute. When did that actually start, that we actually had the children's unit up and running at a...
As a chair, I would like to invite DC Lasley to come up.
You saved me from who was which department, so I'm going to answer. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services. So API, I will get the information on when we actually, we call it the CHOLCAT unit, it's our 10-bed youth unit in the hospital. If you recall back when API was going through its struggles and we reduced census down to about 20 beds, about 80-bed hospital, at that time the CHOLCAT unit had closed. It was, I believe, about 2 years ago that we were able to get that back up and running right in the middle of the pandemic. And we slowly increased that, and I believe it was a year ago last May that we got up to full census. We've been operating at a full census for the past year and a half or so.
I note that in the presentation that this committee heard about the Justice Department investigation, we did not hear anything about API being back open for children, and I think that's I think the biggest concern raised by the Justice Department investigation is not so much the inpatient process, although we needed more inpatient in state, but it's the before and after care, which this report also highlights for adults. It's a huge concern. So I just note that and be interested to see how that plays into this stuff. I know we're running out of time, so I just want to note a couple of things. This is obviously a huge report, and anything that has 90 recommendations, the odds that either the executive branch or the legislature can get all 90 recommendations without any time passed. Wish we could, but the likelihood is not high. So I struck that we need to focus on what can we accomplish in the next year and the next 2 years and start looking at some of those topics. I'll discuss with the committee whether we want to try to have one more meeting following up more questions before we return to Juneau. I would say as committee chair, if we don't do it before we return to Juneau, it's just risen to the top of the stack for what will be taking up some, because this is the sort of report that, at least speaking just as the chair, there's a lot of issues here, and he just doesn't need to fall on the in the stack of reports that have all. Mr. Williams, I think you're here to add a couple of thoughts before we conclude, so please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on that. On the thread of conversation that we've had and the questions that were posed, it's really good dialogue. to Senator Kaufman's point about project management and looking at this very enormous situation and issue with all the varying entities and departments and bodies of government that are involved, that's exactly what we've taken that approach when we've talked about how to transform the system related to crisis now. Now, that's a much smaller piece of this overall discussion this morning, but it is the approach, and I agree with you, having something that lays out how we can get from point A to point B in a sequential approach and making sure that we're tagging in the right bodies and the right individuals informing that process is critical, which is one of the reasons why this report even came to be. Just going back to 2022, as I mentioned, there was lots of dialogue from various parties about ensuring patient rights, and we should be, here's a recommendation to do that, or here's a recommendation to do another thing. And what we were trying to, avoid that conversation. But what we were trying to do is making sure that when we go down this path, we're doing it with all the right information so we don't have unintended consequences that either impact the system or worse, impact the individual experiencing or trying to access services. So I appreciated that commentary and question. The data to Senator Keel, I just want to reiterate what Thea said, that we need to look at the data that we have now. And again, as we're looking at what we're doing with implementing components of the crisis now model in various communities. We're doing that, and we're making sure we're gathering the critical information, not only to make sure that, you know, the system or the services that we're standing up are meeting the needs in the right way, or if not, how do we tweak them, but to be looking forward to saying, okay, now that we're doing this, I mean, really remember, part of this was reducing impact on law enforcement, hospital emergency rooms, and jails. And if we're intervening earlier, whether it's in schools or whether it's with someone in the community, we're getting people healthcare access early on, which hopefully prevents either future need or future intensive need, which has impacts on the highest level of care, which is site API or other residential psychiatric treatment facilities. So we can then be saying, all right, now that this is working, are there opportunities to change the service structure in these higher levels of care to meet maybe people in more acute, who need a higher level of care because of their acuity for a longer period of time? Right now, we are very much treat, stabilize, release. And I know I'm speaking and Senator Keel's nodding his head. So that's why data is important moving forward. So I know we're 1 minute over, and I know you all have a tight schedule, but I just wanted to add that little bit of commentary towards the end. And we really appreciate the opportunity to do a presentation on the report and to be able to use the report and figure out opportunities for the legislature and the departments and the trust to work with us.
So in closing, the one request I'd make of both departments, I know there's recommendations, legislative fixes, but legislative fixes don't always just come from the legislature. So if the either department or the executive branch has plans to introduce legislation at all in the upcoming session that address some of the recommendations here, is it reasonable to see if you could give us an update on that by the 15th of December about whether the administration has plans to introduce any legislation?
Yes, Chairman Clinton, we could get that.
Okay, so I'd ask that as a, I don't need to answer today, but would like to know what the administration's plans are for any proposed legislative responses to the report. And with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. I just noted earlier, we resume our regular meeting schedule when the session starts. I reserve the potential to schedule at least one more meeting, and if I do, it will be on this specific report and follow-up discussion from the committee. Because as I have said, I think this is a really important issue for our community, and we need to keep the report up in front of us. So with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. The time is 11:34, and we are adjourned.